This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of The Progressive Magazine, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can now grab as a podcast or download off our website over at progressive.org. Today we're going to be talking about Jane Addams of Hull House fame, someone I've always wanted to know more about. And now I do, because I've just read Louise Knight's new biography entitled Citizen, Jane Addams and the Struggle for Democracy. And I'm lucky to have Louise Knight right here in the studio with me as my guest today. Louise Knight, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Thank you.
What drew you to Jane Addams?
Well, I'm often asked that question, and in fact, I naturally thought about it a lot at the beginning of this project. I think the first thing that drew me to her was the kind of person that I sensed between the lines in her memoir, 20 Years at Hull House, which I read in college. And I remember it was one of those books where I underlined nearly every sentence. You know, I can't stop underlining.
I'm for underlining in books.
Yeah,
Let's make a passive activity an active activity.
Yeah, so that was my first clue that I was fascinated by her without really knowing why. I know that another piece was that I grew up in a prosperous suburb and I had no exposure at all to the diversity of humanity in the world or in the nation or even in the city of Chicago I was near. And I was struck by the boldness of her idea to go live amongst people whose backgrounds were completely different than her own. And I think that intrigued me.
And she was from a prosperous family herself, not in Chicago, but in a small town in Illinois. Her father was the richest man in the community, owned a mill company, was a state senator. What was he like?
Well, he's quite a remarkably forceful personality. He was very morally earnest, which probably would come as no surprise to anyone who knows Jane Addams, and she was also very morally earnest. He was also religiously devout. He was an evangelical Christian, and that very much informed his commitment to politics. That's what drew him to the state legislature.
But he wasn't an evangelical Christian in the way that we look at right-wing evangelical Christians today, for instance.
Right. Back in the early 19th century, evangelical Christianity was more of a liberal or left-leaning, probably I guess I'd say we would call it liberal, perspective than it was a right-wing or fundamentalist one. The people who were becoming evangelical Christians in his day were people who were interested in making the world a better place and were of activist mentalities. And they now, of course, their definition was to focus on the individual and improving the country by helping individual people learn how to read and write in Sunday school, for example. But they also thought that there should be some role for the state in helping people improve themselves. And they believed in public education, for example. So they were activist bent.
And we still have some left-wing or liberal evangelicals like that in the Black Church, for instance, mm-hmm. or in Jim Wallace's Sojourners group there in Washington, D.C.
Right.
I do have one bone to pick in your description of the Addams household as being upper middle class. I would have just called it flat out upper class. He must have been in the top 1% of American wealth owners and wage earners, won't you say?
No, I don't think he was in the top 1%. I did wrestle with that carefully because I know a lot of folks have assumed that she was upper class and she's described as upper class casually. And I can understand why. And certainly, you know, from the point of view of working class people, what's the difference between upper middle class and upper class? Not a lot. But technically, there were a lot of people who were much, much richer than her family was. Now, because she was in a small town and her father was, if she wasn't necessarily the richest in the township. There were some other men who were richer, but he was probably one of the richest in the town. And so definitely she experienced her growing up years as a member of what you and I would – she had a psychic upper class experience. I would agree with that.
I mean, the only reason I bring it up is I just think there's a flattening notion of what is middle class in this country so that anybody who's making – you know, under $1 million construes themselves as
right.
part of the middle class, and that's just a joke here today. Now, I don't have the breakdown of income from the time of Jane Addams's dad, so you may very well be right, but that's where I was coming from.
Well, and I'm very aware of the flattening of the middle class, too. I mean, my father always considered himself plain old middle class, and he was in the top, you know, I don't know, 10% of the income. But he would, Americans always do that. They always, everyone wants to be in the middle class. And if you aren't, you know, extremely, extremely off the scales wealthy, you think you're middle class. It's a cultural identification, really. And it's not an actual class description.
Now, her mom, Jane Addams's mom, died before Jane Addams was 3, 4, or 5. Anyway, very early on there.
4, 3, yeah.
And that must have had a big impact on her, too.
It did. I had to stop and think, of course, what it would be like for a very, very small child to lose her mother. And it was a very traumatic experience for her, causing her even to have way too intense reactions to other deaths that happened in her family.
And outside her family, too. Death seemed to haunt
her.
That's right.
Yeah, it haunted her as a child. And those memories actually got repressed for a long time and came back to her when she was in her 50s. So that's a signal of how painful the trauma, original trauma of her mother's death was. And I think it contributed to her curiosity about poor people in an interesting way, because in some sense she sensed that they were the people closest to death because they were on the edge of life and suffering more. And I think it contributed to her fascination with them.
You are focusing on the first part of Jane Addams's life, her growing up, her founding of Hull House, the first few years of Hull House, and then you cut it off there. Why'd you do it that way?
There have been not that many biographies about her, but all of them have focused on the second half of her life, except for one new one that came out a few years ago, which, like mine, does the first half. And my feeling, and that person's feeling also, was that the first half of the life was a much richer story than anyone had looked at. And in my case, I suppose in hers too, you know, it was a great desire to understand how she became that person that we all know.
Jane Addams became Jane Addams.
Yeah, the becoming story, as I call it. And to me, that's always my favorite part of any biography anyway. And I think I knew it would be a fascinating story because clearly she traveled a great distance from her background and where she was born, what I call her given life, and then the chosen life that she chose for herself.
You know, I used to do just the opposite. I used to skip over the early part of biographies and just read the stuff where the person jumped
really?
On the public stage. But it's interesting, this distinction between the given life and the chosen life. Do we all have a chosen life?
Oh, what a great question. No, I don't think so. I mean, I think we may think we do sometimes because we think we've made choices. But to the extent that the choices we make are mere extensions of the given life we were born to, then I'm not necessarily persuaded they are real choices, which probably isn't fair on my part because I'm sure there are people who want to continue the life they were born to. But to me, the way you know you're exercising choice is when you pick something that isn't automatic and predicted.
I'm Matt Rothschild. You're listening to Progressive Radio. My guest today is Louise Knight, the biographer of Jane Addams. The new book is called Citizen, Jane Addams and the Struggle for Democracy. She never was a Jane Addams at the beginning, or maybe she was Jane Addams in miniature with the raising of her father's moralistic ideas and everything, but she wasn't the strong Jane Addams even in the 20s, at least in some of those years. I mean, she was very successful at college, precocious, excelled, valedictorian at Rockford. So that seemed to me, all right, I figured once I got there, it's the very next page is going to be Jane Addams as Jane Addams. But then for a decade almost, she kind of wanders, and she even has what I would call a nervous breakdown. What was that about, and how did she get over it?
Yeah, it's a part of her life that she subsequently felt very regretful of. She felt like she wasted those years. I don't agree with her because, of course, as a biographer, I can see the process she was going through. But the older Jane Addams was impatient with the younger Jane Addams's failure to, you know, dive into her chosen life. The issues surrounded her family's expectations of her and also society's expectations of young women like her. She clearly was supposed to get married and have children. She did not want to do that. And therefore, the next thing she was supposed to do was take care of her family as the single daughter. And that meant staying with her stepmother, living in Cedarville, and then visiting her sisters and their children. And so that was, and then going to Europe because she was had wealth, and so she could afford to acquire culture that way. And that was the life she was leading. But it was not the life she wanted to lead. And she had had great dreams, as you say, in college. And so the gap between her intense ambition and the life she was leading made her very depressed.
The dream she had as a young woman was to become a doctor, was to go to Smith College in Northampton, Massachusetts, and become a doctor. What happened to that? Why did she have that dream, and what happened to it?
Yeah. She, as best we can see, she seems to have had that dream even before she went to college, Rockford Seminary. Because one reason she wanted to go to Smith was they had excellent scientific training, whereas Rockford did not. It had hardly any scientific training except botany, you know, gathering plants. So I think she had this dream in high school, and I think it was related to the fact that she had a number of doctors around her who she admired. The family doctor in the village was a man she admired very much. She had a stepbrother who was a doctor. She read novels about doctors who took care of the poor. One of Dickens' novels included a doctor that was like that, and she loved reading Dickens. So what happened was that she did eventually get 1 year of medical school under her belt, her first year out of college, only because her father had died and the whole family went to Philadelphia where there was a women's college. But then she did have this nervous breakdown, and it severely undermined her confidence in her ability to get a medical degree. I think the other issue, though, was that she wasn't good at science.
And that was a funny thing, wasn't it?
Yeah. And, you know, here
and she was great at writing and oratory.
Yeah, she was not a scientist. She didn't have a scientific mind, and she had a literary mind. She had a powerful humanistic mind. She had a philosophical mind, a psychological mind. She did not have a scientific mind. And I think that was part of the issue, too. So really, she wasn't going to be good at being a doctor. But then on top of that, she had problems with her back. She had back surgery. And then she was very depressed. So she couldn't get back on the track that she had expected of herself, and it left her with not knowing what to do.
So she's traveling through Europe. She has this bad back and this operation. She has a nervous breakdown. At that point, it doesn't seem possible that Jane Addams is going to become Jane Addams. And how did that transpire?
Yeah, that was interesting because it was something that I really had to figure out by really studying the evidence that was available. And what happened was that she read some books. Books were extremely important to her, and she found in these books ideas that freed her from some of the limiting assumptions of her upbringing. And one was John Stuart Mill's The Subjection of Women. And he said, you know, there's nothing more devastating and destroying of the pleasure of life than to have no active use for your faculties, no outlet for your talents. And Addams must have thought that to be a very powerful insight, because she later quoted that sentence in one of her first speeches when she got to Chicago. So that was important, that she could finally understand why she was so depressed, that she had no outlet for her faculties. Another problem was that she thought her duty was to her family. And she read a book by Giuseppe Mazzini called Duties of Man, in which he says men, he didn't mean women, but she read it to mean her, men are selfish if they serve the family first and do not serve humanity first. And Addams said, yeah, I like that. Okay, it's selfish if I don't go do what I wanted to do. I don't have to feel so selfish for leaving the family and not making it my priority. That was a huge breakthrough for her.
So that was liberating. And then how did she arrive at this settlement house notion, though, which seemed to spring out of nowhere here in the United States anyway?
Yeah, it was. She had always wanted to live among the poor, is what she tells us, and I think that's plausible. But
I don't know about that, though. She said she was... Since 6 years old, she wanted to work among the poor.
Well, I actually think that was an actual dream. I mean, I think it came out of the dream she'd had earlier, and I think it makes sense psychologically for reasons I explain in the book. I totally understand why people think it's like too perfect a little story, you know. But the psyche is like that, and once you start to understand that her interest in the poor comes from a deep psychic place, which relates to her fascination with their relationship to death, then to me it becomes more plausible that her psyche would have supplied this idea when she was younger. And her mother was very active among the poor, too, so she had that image in her mind. But be that as it may, it's clear that in her by the time she was in seminary, she wanted to be a doctor and live among the poor. So that's a phrase. I don't think she knew what it meant, but I think she had the idea. Then she didn't know how to do it. So where she got the Settlement House idea from was a magazine article about the first Settlement House in the world, which was Toynbee Hall, which was in London. And it opened in December 1883, and she read about it. And it was all about well-educated Oxford and Cambridge young men going to live in the East End of London, which is a working-class neighborhood, and bringing their culture to have social ties to these working-class people and learning something from working-class people about their lives. And it's all vague and slightly romantic, but fascinating to her. So when she went to Europe the second trip, she decided to visit Toynbee Hall, which she did, and she was fascinated. So that's where the idea came from.
I'm speaking with Louise Knight, who has a biography out on Jane Addams called Citizen, Jane Addams and the Struggle for Democracy. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild, the editor of the Progressive Magazine. There is a sense among some people about Jane Addams and also about Toynbee Hall that it's upper-class slumming, or that there's an element, a strong element or flavor of condescension, that these upper-class people are going to bring the high culture to these unwashed. To what extent did that typify some of the work she was doing, and did she change in some way, or was that never a part of it?
Yeah, it was definitely a part of it, because it was definitely part of the way she was raised and was implicit in the model, I think. Two things interest me about it. One is that, of course, they were unaware that this attitude of condescension was in them. So they had a philosophy that lacked that particular rhetoric. They didn't buy into the idea that's what they were doing. So they were not self-aware sufficiently to critique it inside themselves. And Addams did gradually understand that, and she began to realize the condescension involved in the method and really shifted her own outlook. But the other thing that I had to give some thought to was, absolutely was condescending, but there was a piece of it that wasn't. We don't think that it's condescending to offer Shakespeare in the park, right? We don't think these movements, there's a movement at Stanford and other universities to offer working-class people the liberal arts education through a series of classes at night. We don't think that's condescending, because there are people in every class and every walk of life who want to learn about the great ideas of civilization. Granted, in her day, civilization was defined to be Western. You know, we are more wise now about understanding there's a world civilization that has great ideas. But the bottom line is, there are great ideas that if you're in the working class and you're going to the factory all day, you don't have any contact with. If you didn't go to a good high school, you never got in high school. Well, why should people who are working class people not have the benefit of learning what they want to learn about the great ideas of the world? So I don't think it was fully condescending. And certainly, they were the only ones in their day that thought that. I mean, most people would never have thought it was worthwhile for a working class person to learn anything. So I think we can't miss that piece of it.
Louise Knight, in reading your book, Citizen, Jane Addams and the Struggle for Democracy, it's the story of Jane Addams becoming more than a do-gooder, more than this person who wants to go give people who are not educated the high arts and also some social supports. That we know about Jane Addams. But what you lead us through is her development kind of politically in several ways. I mean, the first really was in her approach to bosses or owners or capitalists, because her father, who she idealized and evidently was a man of great rectitude, was an employer, and it seemed difficult for her to understand that employers could be so heartless. And you talk about an encounter she had with what you call the match girls, or what were called the match girls, these young women who were working in match factories. Tell me about their conditions and how she tried to resolve it and how she was stymied.
Well, yeah, actually, she met the match girls when she was visiting Toynbee Hall. And so she didn't get involved in their particular situation, but it was the first time she went to a strike meeting. And what she said was that she didn't understand what they were really doing. She didn't understand what the union needed to be formed for. And they, of course, were working with phosphorus, which creates a disease called Fossey jaw, which disfigures the face and destroys the body, and it's a horrible way to die. And she saw women who were suffering from that disease. So she was sympathetic, of course, and wretched, by their condition. But she didn't understand. They had to have a union to solve it. Mm.
So I must have confused that story with another one, though, because there was a story in your book in Chicago where she goes to the employer after hearing the plight of some workers, and the employer just didn't do anything.
Right. Went back later, when she got to Hull House, there were children who came to Hull House to participate in the clubs, and many of them worked in factories and would come after their factory work. And two boys were both working in the same factory. And first, one of them hurt his arm on a machine because it had no guard on it. And Adams, in her innocence, thought all she needed to do was go visit the owner of the factory and say, "You need to put a guard on your machine," and that he would do it. And, of course, he laughed at her and said, "You know, why should I do that?" And then the next thing that happened was that another boy at the same factory was killed by one of the pieces of equipment because it was unsafe. And this was the beginning of her understanding that you know, owners had other motives for making decisions besides kindness and sympathy to their employees, that they were crassly bottom line sometimes and only were interested in profit. And their attitude was basically, well, if there's one child dead, I'll go find another child. And that was a real shock to her. And it was the beginning of her understanding that you have to have unions to apply pressure, powerful pressure on the owners in order to get them to act.
And she was bravely open at Hull House, and they had a speaking event, a weekly or something speaking event that drew 1,000 people sometimes. Hundreds of people, anyway, and open to radical labor agitators. That certainly couldn't have endeared her to some of her patrons who gave money to Hull House. Why do you think she was so open to that?
She always had, I'm not sure where she got this part from. I think it was maybe her intellectual curiosity initially, but she always just wanted to hear all the different perspectives. And I think that she felt it was a good thing to have a discussion, and obviously she believed that more and more deeply as time went on because she experienced the dangers of when open discussion and issues are not explored when in the times of her life where she was criticized for speaking frankly about an issue. But I think she also just found it very interesting, and she thought the anarchist point of view was fascinating, and the socialists had a point of view too. So she liked the debate.
She got involved then in Chicago with this move to crack down on sweatshop oppression.
Mm-hmm.
And how did she involve herself in that?
She was drawn into that by other women in Chicago who were already deeply involved in the issue. The Chicago Women's Club had helped lobby the city of Chicago to pass a law against sweatshops. The Illinois Women's Alliance, which was a cross-alliance of labor union women and club women, had lobbied the state legislature on the issue. Florence Kelly, who arrived at Hull House in early 1892, was a very experienced lobbyist in Pennsylvania and New York State on sweatshop reform. So Adams was drawn in by the examples and engagement of these other women. She had grave doubts initially about becoming political activist because she thought that she couldn't, but here she was watching these other women do it. She thought because she didn't have the vote that there was no way for her to be political.
Well, let's talk about that and her role in the women's suffrage movement. She wasn't quick on that stage, but she came around.
Yeah. She did write a editorial in college where she, you know, endorsed the idea of women getting the vote. That was in 1880. But it never gets mentioned again anywhere in her writings or in any speech until 1897. And at that point, she takes it up as a cause. And one of the issues I was curious about was why. And as far as I can figure out, it was her experiences of fighting to evict the corrupt aldermen from the ward of their part of the Chicago that taught her that it really mattered whether women could have the vote in a really immediate way. Because if the women of the ward had been able to vote against this corrupt alderman, he would have been out. And as it was, all the women at Hull House were struggling to persuade the men to vote against him, and many of the men were getting their jobs from the alderman's dealings and were basically loyal to him for personal reasons because he was kind to them. But some of the women were better able to get a distance on the guy, but they couldn't vote. So she was very frustrated by that. And she also realized that she and the other women at Hull House had no credibility in their fight against the corrupt alderman in the eyes of the men voters because they were women and couldn't vote. So the men voters said, "What are you doing getting involved in politics? This isn't your bailiwick." And so she realized that women needed the vote to be credible as political activists also.
How active was she in the suffrage movement after that?
Yeah, she went on to become a vice president of the National American Women's Suffrage Association, and went all over the country giving pro-suffrage speeches. She wrote a wonderful essay called "What If Women? What If Men Didn't Have the Vote?" And you know what the case would be made by what the women would say to the men with why they shouldn't get the vote.
A little turnaround.
She eventually was active in the international women's suffrage movement also.
I was just going to go, Louise Knight, to another issue that she joined, and that is the anti-imperialist issue. She was a member of the Anti-Imperialist League that opposed U.S. The Spanish-American War in 1898, and actually she opposed U.S. entry into World War I, too. Where did this come from?
It actually came from a much earlier interest in nonviolence or nonresistance, which she was an idea she gained from reading Leo Tolstoy's book, My Religion, in the 1880s. Tolstoy, as many know, was an articulate proponent of nonviolence or nonresistance. And he was vastly influential on a lot of left-leaning, reform-minded people in Europe and the United States in the 1880s and 90s through his writings. And Adams was one of the many he influenced. So she came to Hull House with a belief in nonviolence, and she applied it in her personal relations to the neighborhood. But she didn't apply it to the idea of war until the Spanish-American War came out. And then she wrote to a friend. She said she was very blue, and she was going to have to decide whether to be more of a Tolstoyan or less of a Tolstoyan right off, because she couldn't set the issue aside, and she became more of a Tolstoyan.
That reminded me of Martin Luther King Jr.'s decision to oppose Vietnam, because they knew they were stuck here on their principles, and
right.
They were going to be true to their principles or they weren't. They both made the same decision. She actually met Leo Tolstoy, and that was kind of an interesting part of your book. At the we're toward the end of our conversation now, and I'm struck by a comment that Adams made that we are not born citizens, but we need to become them. How do we become citizens today? Or what would Jane Addams tell us to do to become citizens today?
She expresses it best in the introduction to her first book. The book was titled Democracy and Social Ethics, and it's still in print. And in there, she says in her elliptical, poetic way, that if you want to have a healthy democracy and if you want to be a strong, vital citizen, you have to know people from all walks of life. You have to step outside your comfort zone is what we would say. You have to put yourself in situations where you will get to know people whose backgrounds and lives are completely different from your own and to understand each other's burdens that way. And it seems like a philosophical point, but it's a profound point because anyone who's had that experience knows that your politics change completely when you understand how other people's lives, the forces that are shaping other people's lives.
One final prurient question. A lot of people wonder whether Jane Addams was a lesbian. You have two accounts here of her very close relationship with people she worked with at Hull House. Do you have a clue there?
Yeah, my answer to that question is, how are you defining lesbian? I'd say she was definitely a lesbian if you define it as a primary emotional partnership, committed long-term partnership with a person of the same sex. The question of sexuality is complicated by the fact that Addams was very much a Platonist, which means that she thought that sensuality was a low and inferior state and that you should aspire to sublimate your sexuality into a love of beauty. This was her intellectual view. We don't know how she practiced it. We don't know whether she successfully sublimated her sexuality, but I'd say she certainly aspired in that direction.
Well, if she did, she did a lot of good with that sublimation. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Louise Knight, it's been a pleasure speaking with you. Your book again is Citizen, Jane Addams and the Struggle for Democracy. Thanks for being my guest.
Thanks so much.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.